Welcome to episode 81 of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. This is Janae Libby. Would like to give a shout out to a couple of sponsors, Teej.fm, that is TEEJ.fm, a podcast collaborative community put upon by WTJU. Check out Teej.fm for more information. And Patreon. I've been saying it wrong this entire time, folks. It's patreon.com. Check out patreon.com/audaciouspod to learn how you can be a sponsor of this podcast for as little as a dollar a month, making sure that artists and creators like myself stay solvent and continue to grow. patreon.com/audaciouspod. Coming to you live today from an undisclosed porch in Appalachia. Check it out. It's Cricket Land here at Audacious, and it's episode 81. Welcome. Here we go. Hey, you guys, it's Janae Libby coming to you from, like I said, an undisclosed front porch somewhere in Appalachia. It's not so undisclosed. I got the chance to escape for a few days to Foggy Ridge Cider down here in Dougspur. I'm not sure whether you know it or not, but Diane Flint has a garden cottage for rent, available for rent whenever you would like to escape civilization for a bit, escape life for a bit. I got the chance to escape, and I took it, honey. It's pre-fall here in Appalachia. I'm sitting on the front porch of a gorgeous, Pinterest-worthy garden cottage with a potting shed attached, a lovely deck on the side. There is a hoop house and a full garden right next to the cottage. And if that wasn't enough, you've got hummingbirds, you've got blackberries on the porch, you've got crickets, and a creek. Chisholm Creek runs behind the cottage and has lulled me to sleep every night for the past 3 nights. Are you jealous yet? You might want to be jealous. I'll have the link in the show notes. Thank you so much, Diane, for providing me with this space to podcast and to create and to talk about community and wine, because my guest today is Jake Bushing of Jake Bushing Wines. I find it very ironic that Jake, being a old punk rock dude, he was the lead singer for a punk rock band, and he also knows quite a bit about audio. He actually went to school for it. That I am probably doing the worst thing you can do when it comes to audio. I'm sitting outside, there's a slight breeze, and there's lots of ambient noise in the form of insects. Sorry, Jake. I've been improving my audio since we talked, but you know, I just could not pass up the opportunity to share a little bit of nature with you guys, to share a little bit of this garden cottage magic here in Dougspur, Virginia, to share a little bit of the Foggy Ridge magic. Every morning, I have sat out here and written on my book. I don't know if you know this, but I am writing a book. I've gotten a lot of work done. A little garden gnome has left me vegetables on the front porch every morning. This morning, it was a bucket full of apples. As Diane likes to say, ugly apples taste the best because they are heritage. They're not sprayed. They're not curated. They just grow the way they're supposed to grow, and they taste delicious. I had one for lunch, and I'll probably have another or two for dinner. And yeah, you can probably hear the rest in my voice, the peace in my voice. I am a podcaster. This is Audacious. You can find me at audacious.co is the website, on the Purple Podcast app if you've got an iPhone. If you don't, you can search out any of your favorite podcast apps in the Google Apps thingy and look for Audacious. It's a vintage word that means hungry. It means passionate. I am audacious about today's talk with Jake Bushing. Not only did we talk about wine, Not only did we talk about Richmond, because we both have ties to Richmond, we talked about audio. And after the audio cut off, after the conversation was over, we talked another hour and a half. I think I might have made a new friend talking to Jake. And his wine is extraordinary. It's fantastic. He bequeathed me a bottle of his 2015 Viognier. It's delicious. It is otherworldly. It is sublime. I enjoyed it with a nice scallop risotto and immediately went to his website and bought all of the wines available at jakebushingwines.com. I believe that is the link. I'm sitting on a porch, so we don't have internet here in Dougspur. It's you can hear planes every so often. That is about the only tie to civilization. I think I've talked to maybe two people in 4 days, and guys, it's glorious. But I am still here podcasting, bringing those community conversations to you, using food as only a starting point to talk about so, so many other things. Things like, what is the nature of success? Why are we here? What is our purpose? And we certainly do that in today's conversation with Jake Bushing of Jake Bushing Wines. I am rambling. So rather than me ramble, let's get to the conversation, shall we? And before we do, let me leave you with a little bit of the sounds of Chisholm Creek. Enjoy my conversation with Jake and enjoy the ambient sounds of a burbling creek in Dougspur, Virginia. See you on the flip side. Cheers. Interviewed Sarah Aducci and actually said sibilance, and she got the reference, which made me very happy because I've done that before, and the guest just kind of looks at me like, what are you doing? I don't understand.
Yeah, check one, check two.
All right.
Yes, indeed.
And I think we're good. All right, say something for me, and I'll do a little mini test here.
I really wanted to do this interview in the car, and I realized that sound doesn't work that way, but it would have been fantastic to take you out and roll you through like 10 vineyards in a day like I do. It would have been kind of fun.
That would have been nice because it's like that's when you listen.
Yeah, that's when I'm working. I mean, that's like I'm in my car, I drive to Carter's Mountain, and
yeah,
spend an hour there, and then I get in my car and drive to Orange, and I'm up there for 2 hours, and then I drive across to Earliesville, and then I drive down to Pippin Hill, and yeah, that's my daily rodeo.
And is that all consulting? Like consulting
yeah.
work?
Mm-hmm.
That's what. And let's just jump right into it. Thank you for talking with me today and taking
Absolutely.
Time out of your car.
My pleasure. I am not in a car. It's Friday.
I know I got your email and you said that you listened to me quite a bit driving around, which made me so happy because when I first started, the food folks were the people who reached out first. They were my first supporters. I had
yeah.
bakers tell me that they listen at 2 a.m. when they're making bread and
yeah.
and you're listening in the car. And that's just, it keeps me going. So I appreciate it so much.
Well, you're doing a fantastic job. And
thanks. Man.
The things I'm learning about my friends through your podcast are fantastic.
You're like, oh, I didn't know that.
I'm like, huh, really? Wilson Ritchie. I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, right.
No, it's good. Really good. And when you're just lost in space out driving around, you get sick of music.
Oh, sure.
Real fast.
Sure.
And having some sort of intellectual stimulus that's personal, you know, it's, hello, hometown. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's been wonderful.
So oh, thanks a lot.
Thanks for letting me join the band.
Right. That you've been in bands. What do you play?
So I sang in a band back in Minneapolis in the after tech school. I was in a band for 3 or 4 years. And I was actually singing and writing. It was all original, sort of punk, goth, prog rock kind of weird thing.
Yeah.
And it was just a way to, you know, escape the snowbanks and, you know, do something creative, I guess.
Sure.
And then when we got sick of being cold and dark, you know, half the band were like, this is over. So Turtle and I jumped in the truck and moved to Richmond. And that was like 92. So.
Wow.
And it. You know, and he continued on, and he actually stayed in music, and that's where I found food.
Oh, cool.
So this pale, young Minnesotan boy finds Richmond in 1992.
That's kind of like...
Culture shock?
Yeah, a little bit. Because we talked a little bit off mic. That's a good year for Richmond. Like, for music, for... The nightlife, it was still gritty.
It was dark.
No, yeah.
And I mean that on a lot of levels. There was a dark time for Richmond. I mean, that was, you know, top five murder capital of the country for 3-4 years there. And there was a lot of really good music going on because of it, probably, just economically. But we found a home there that felt pretty great.
Right. You know?
It's like I lived like 2 blocks from the village for a long time.
And
I mean, that's right in the middle of, just off campus. And
I lived on Franklin Street for a long time.
I was on Franklin. Like,
no kidding. Like, do you remember the address?
No, but if you walk from the village up to Franklin, you go half a block and it was right there.
Left or right?
It was on the, if you're walking, it'd be on the left.
If I left the village and turned left at 9:24.
Okay. Yeah. We're at like 11:02 or something.
Holy
like
that. Crap. Seriously, that's amazing.
I guarantee you we're at the village at the same time.
I bet we were. Now, is this the old village or when it crossed the street?
No, the old one.
The old one. Yeah. The good, like, well, the
where
new
Dirt
one's okay.
Woman used to sell the calendars.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And Brandon Fox was the waitress. Now she's a food writer for Style Magazine or Richmond Magazine, one of those. My God, we'll sit here and reminisce about Richmond for the entire hour.
How much time did you spend at ODC?
Okay. Way too much because I knew the owner. Oh, my goodness. No. Yeah. Okay, we will definitely have to talk wine on a porch sometime about our shared...
Yeah, let's do that.
...dirty adventures, probably. Ay, ay, ay.
But... You know, for me, that's so growing up, I grew up in a family that, I wasn't allowed in the kitchen. I was a boy. And if there was fire and meat involved, I learned how to do that from dad. But, you know, I never learned to cook. So when I left home, I was pretty hopeless in the kitchen.
Right.
And so when I got to Richmond, you know, I needed a job and I ended up working, at Christine's Restaurante in the Holiday Inn downtown.
I don't remember that place.
It was on Franklin going towards downtown.
Yeah. That scary Holiday Inn.
Yeah. That was the restaurant in there.
Yeah.
Close to where I live. So that was my introduction to restaurant life, which for me was it was culture shock in a huge way because I grew up in a very white, segregated, rural community, and you know, I walk into this place and get a job, and all the wait staff are gay, and the kitchen staff are all these old black men that I could not understand.
Wow!
And I was like, "What was hello. That?
hello, world!
Figure this out.
I'm out of my element."
Yeah, way out. But it was great.
What did you learn? I'm curious. Like,
it was actually where I learned the value of food because before that, I was like. Kind of that whole, you know, we just didn't care about anything. It was, you know, very cynical.
Yeah.
Dark times, you know, for our generation. And I still carry that around with me, but, the culture of food that's what hit me because, you know, Eddie Bozier, the chef there he'd get on me. He's like, what do you mean you've never had this? And it was like grits. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Like,
There aren't any grits in Minnesota.
No.
And so I started to understand culture and then the identity of culture and how it's sort of attached to food. So listening to what you do, oh my God, it's fantastic. Cause now I'm starting to build those, you know, sort of broaden the net of what food is all about.
Sure.
But that's where it started.
That's so cool.
And then I worked at Bogart's.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh my God. I love Bogart's. They had this sandwich. It was a potato pancake.
Yeah. It's all named after Bogart films. The whole thing.
I want to say McGillicuddy, and that's not right. It had this funny name.
Yeah,
it was like
that big fold.
Pastrami and a potato pancake. That was like my jam. Fantastic. I never ordered anything else. That was the best.
I waited tables there for about 4 months, and then I was, we went through people fast, and I was a manager there for like a year.
Really?
And I had the Friday night bar, Sunday morning bar, which is a really fun bar.
Oh boy.
And the fan.
Yeah. Oh my God. Everybody's stumbling in.
Oh wow.
The brunch culture of Richmond in the 90s. Yeah. No kidding. Like Joe's Inn and Sidewalk Cafe and all those John and Norman's. Love John
like
and Norman's.
Everybody just walking around in a fog on Sunday morning. Just kind of.
And musicians and food. That's just a thing. I feel like that needs to be a book because so many musicians started work in restaurants because of the hours and the pay and it left them free at night to do gigs and all that stuff.
And the
culture.
And the creativity.
Yeah.
You need an outlet when your brain is just on hyper creative all the time and you've got to do something with it. Being in a restaurant, super fast paced, everything's moving, you get in a groove with a good restaurant and it's like, you don't even know you're there.
You're just
flying through the night.
Yeah.
I loved that energy. It was fantastic.
I like that about bartending. That's still my favorite job ever. Cause you just hustle for 4 or 5 hours and you walk out with a wad of cash in your pocket, and you're bone tired and you drink a lot and go right to sleep.
Yeah. And that was it was a great transition for me to go from playing music to restaurant food. And then the wine thing happened.
Yeah. And how did that how did you go from food to wine? How did you land in Charlottesville?
So I met a girl.
That's always how it starts. Yeah.
So I actually met a girl when I was at Bogart's and she worked there. And then I hit a point where, I realized that I needed to transition out of dark and cynical into some sort of a path to be an adult. So I needed to move back to Minnesota for a while and just clear my head and, do that thing.
Yeah.
And she followed me. And so
she took the leap.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we ended up getting married and then she hated living in Minneapolis because it's not nice in the winter.
It's super cold.
She actually grew up in Singapore. So she's like, this sucks. And so she wanted to do. She was getting her master's in education, so we moved back down here. She went to Stanton, and I was like, I'm not living in Stanton, because in 1995...
It's very different.
No, there was nothing there.
Yeah.
Didn't want to go back to Richmond, so we found Charlottesville.
Okay.
So when we moved here, I actually worked for Sunbow Trading Company downtown, the rug store, for a while.
Oh, wow.
That's a whole other podcast.
I bet.
Yeah. Saul was fantastic people, is fantastic people. But I met the owner of Jefferson Vineyards while I worked at the rug store. He used to come in and he'd sit on this big stack of rugs in the afternoon and sip tea, just hang out and chat. And so we got to be friends and he's like, hey, are you looking for something to do besides this? And I grew up on a farm. Like, that's my background.
Okay.
I learned to drive a tractor when I was 10, and it was just dirt and cows and farming. So that's where the whole dirt thing comes into play.
Right. I was going to ask about that because they call you the dirt guy.
Yeah. And that I just grew up, barefoot in the dirt.
Yeah.
And so when I talked to Stanley Woodward, he's was the owner of Jefferson. He's like, you want to come work on the farm? And my brain went, farm sounds pretty good.
I know that.
We were about to have a baby, and I was like, this sounds great. So I actually started working at Jefferson in spring of 97.
Man.
Took over the farm management, hay and cows and all that stuff. There happened to be a vineyard there.
Oh, nice.
And so the guy who was the vineyard manager there at the time, Chris Hill, he's like, you know how to fix stuff? I'm like, yeah. So he and I hit it off immediately. And I started taking care of their tractors and sprayers and started to do a bunch of the work. And then I had this epiphanous moment with Chris. We were out laying out, he needed help laying out a vineyard at Jefferson. And we started talking about the industry, which I didn't really know anything about it. In 97.
Yeah. And back then it was still kind of, they were like pretty young.
15 wineries or something, and not a lot. So it seemed like a really great launch point suddenly in my head. Like, here's an industry. Mm-hmm. It's starting to take off. There were 3 or 4 winemakers at the time who were actually really focused on making quality wine.
Okay.
Michael Schaps was one of those guys, and he was the winemaker at Jefferson then.
Okay.
And so that's where I learned kind of what the industry was about to do. And it's funny, listening to your interview with Tim, and I go back to like 98.
That
loved him.
Yeah. And, oh, he was a hoot.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's there's a cast of characters at that time that really got me interested in the industry from that creative perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, this is a really interesting, the farm boy in me was like, the seasonality of this totally makes sense to me. Grow a crop, harvest the crop, turn it into wine. Wow.
Yeah.
Like, wow. From an agricultural perspective, that sounded like, sign me up.
Yeah.
And then I started meeting people in the industry. I was like, this is a freak show of really, really interesting people.
Yeah.
And that's really what solidified it for me.
That's and especially here, because I know, like, around the world, I watch a lot of wine documentaries and stuff, and there's so many, like, scholarly, like, snobby, like, studious.
Yeah.
And I love here, it's a little more like, oh, what's that great movie about Napa where they take on the French wine and they win?
Yes.
It's cute. It's a cute film, but it's more a little more rock and roll, a little more like seat of our pants, like, oh, let's try this and maybe it'll work. And
for me, that's the Virginia wine industry is, you know, where Napa Valley was 25 years ago.
I think so too.
I mean, there's some major differences where we will never be Napa Valley from a viticultural perspective. We can't just blanket the place with grapevines because that doesn't work here.
Yeah.
But the quality and sort of the focus of on what we're doing is, you know, we're on that journey.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're totally on that journey. And, you know, those kind of movies help us because people go, oh, well, what's going on here? And there's actually, we filmed a movie, or I was took part in the filming of a movie in 2008 in Virginia.
Really?
And it was done by Silverthorne Films, and it's called A Winemaker's Year, and no one knows about it. It ran on PBS for a while.
It did? I think I've seen a trailer for it or something. The title sounds so familiar to me.
The cinematography is fantastic.
Yeah.
And so what they did, and this was sort of the wine community wanted to broaden the scope of, you know, of our marketing share. So they're like, well, let's make a movie about what we do and teach some people some things, and we'll put it out and see what happens. So they strapped us up with microphones for a year. And so,
oh my God,
they started following us in April of 2008. And we went through an entire vintage with a film crew. So we'd get these calls like, hey, what are you doing today? Is anything moving? How do you make a movie about grapevines growing quietly out in a field?
Yeah, yeah.
So there are like all these ongoing interviews throughout the year. And every time we were doing something where there was any action whatsoever, they're like, we need you to, you know, every time you do something, call us. We need to be there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
That's so cool.
They followed King Family, Veritas, Blenheim, Trump. I was at Pollock at the time. And I know I'm at Whitehall, So it was sort of a Monticello wine area film. And they did a whole year of just following us around. And
I'm thinking, do you remember being nervous that year? Like, oh my God, I hope The Harvest is good because we're making this movie and what if it sucks? And
no, that was never the thought because we know that growing grapes here sucks.
Right.
Almost every year. Yeah. We're just like, hopefully no one dies. Right. let's have a good vintage where we all survive it. Yeah. And there's wine.
Yes.
It was a typical year in Virginia in that, you know, the weather gives us hell every year.
And yeah.
So, but following that through the film, and I love looking back, and I haven't watched it in a couple of years, but looking back on that and
10 years ago almost.
Yeah.
It'd be fun to look back on it. And
it would be really fun, actually.
Laugh and cringe and go, oh, well, that was good. That part was good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, look how old we all look now.
I know. Oh, my God. Isn't that the truth? Jesus.
Yeah. I think Tim's still wearing the same hat, though.
Yeah. He's still got the same hat. That's so funny. Well, and you have worked in so many different vineyards around. What is it exactly that you do, like, as part of your wine work? Like, vineyard manager, what does that mean? Because a lot of my listeners, and I'm woefully ignorant on wine.
So I'll answer that with sort of a back trail. So getting into the industry, you know, classically in Europe, you learn dirt. You learn how to grow grapes. And you do that for a long time. You transition into the winery with those grapes and learn to make wine. And, you know, hopefully you've got a team of winemaker and vineyard manager.
Okay.
You've got the guy, the farmer that grows the grapes, and the chemist that makes the wine.
Yeah.
In Virginia, a lot of our wineries are, you know, there's a lot of money being spent in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of money being made in Virginia.
Hmm.
The wine industry it's agriculture. It's a hard thing to do.
Sure.
There's a lot of wineries for sale. So for me, what I learned first, and I had the dirt under my fingernails already, so it was grape growing. And I did that for Jefferson Vineyards. I worked for Horton for a little while and just started to learn how to grow grapes for winemaking.
Hmm.
And then I got a call to go to Pollock and build an actual business.
Oh, wow. From the ground up.
Whoa. And heck yeah, let's do that.
Sure.
So in 2003, I went to work for Dave Pollock, Dave and Margo. Great move. Oh my God, they were so supportive, and it's such a wonderful operation, and I learned so much there. So I was able to apply my viticulture there, my grape growing.
Okay.
Which that's really the term that we like to use, us dirt guys, is wine growing.
Okay, right.
I'm not growing grapes. I'm growing wine, and it's a perspective issue. If you're out there and you're growing grapes, that means you're trying to grow as many grapes as you can to make money with an agricultural crop.
Gotcha.
If you're a wine grower, you're trying to grow the grapes in a way that's going to make the best wine possible.
Hmm.
And it's a different perspective. So
yeah. What, and on your site, it says artisanal wines. Mm-hmm. So it's with the intent of not selling, you know, so many bottles, but making the best bottles you absolutely can.
Absolutely. And so that learning, I learned to grow wine, and then I transitioned into the winery at Pollock. Michael Schaps came in to consult and taught me to make wine.
Hmm.
So I went from grape grower, wine maker.
Oh, fantastic.
General manager, plumber, electrician, mechanic.
Right.
But that was a long time. I mean, that was the first, you know, 10, 12 years of what I was doing was all learning how the whole industry works.
That's great.
So I got all that under my belt. So what I do now, I took that knowledge. I built Pollock Vineyards, and then I went over and built Grace Estate for John Grace up there in Mount Juliet. It's a wonderful farm. I love that place. And then I realized that I have enough knowledge that I could put it to work in a broader spectrum.
Nice. So, that your name kept coming up here very recently. I would go talk with people. Have you talked to Jake Bushing yet? I was at Virginia Distillery, and Emma Stotts mm-hmm. brought your name up, as did Amanda, and that they were like the fourth or fifth person, so that's why I emailed you. I'm like, okay, I believe in signs. This is getting ridiculous. I better email him the minute I get home. Because she said she had worked with you at Grace Estate.
Yeah, Emma was our tasting room manager there.
Yeah.
Great people.
Yeah. Really
great people. And that, you know, and that end of the business is still one of the most wonderful things about what we do. I'd be happy being on a tractor lost in a vineyard all day, but the truth of what we do is selling wine, and that's the hardest part of what we do.
Yes. It's pretty, Tim talked about that.
It's pretty easy to grow grapes and make wine.
Sure.
You're not going to necessarily make any money at it, but you can do it. And you can do it well, or you can do it however you want to do it. Selling wine is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
And finding the right people to do that is critical.
And getting people out to the winery to try it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your gimmick?
Yeah, right. How do you do it?
What else do you offer?
Exactly.
That's a hard thing.
Well, and your wines, again, there's a different model for selling.
This is a new thing for Virginia, actually, and there's only a couple of us doing it, and it's partly because the legality of doing what I'm doing is pretty sketchy.
Mm-hmm.
But being an independent winemaker and selling your own wine without a tasting room, I don't own a vineyard, I don't own a winery. I'm a winemaker that really needs to have that creative outlet for what I do. I'm doing it for other people now. So back to your question of what do I do? I went to work for Michael Schaps, and Michael and I have been friends, you know, since 97 or whatever it was. And, you know, he had lost his winemaker and he called me. He's like, oh my God, you know, my winemaker just left. And I was like, well, I'm ready to move. So why don't we finally work together? And, you know, so we did. And so cool. I was his winemaker in 2015, and we worked, you know, he's building this custom crush facility where we make wine for other clients.
Okay.
We have 16 wineries that we make wine for.
Whoa.
So most of the wineries around here, outside of a couple of the big ones, make 3,000 to 5,000 cases of wine a year. We're doing 26,000, but that goes out to, you know, a lot of different clients.
Interesting.
So we're making wine for Pippin Hill. We make all that. Michael Schaps' wines are there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then there's a lot of other smaller wineries out in the world that we fulfill all their wine as well.
Well, okay. I knew this. I don't think a lot of our listeners did, though. That brings up an interesting question. When those wineries win awards mm-hmm. for wines that you guys made, how does that work?
It depends on who you are.
Yeah. Well, it's like I talked to a food writer, and she does recipes for many award-winning cookbooks that have won medals and honors, and she can't take credit. Yeah. She's got to stay silent.
We're in a slightly different situation where most of the owners of these places, they need that acknowledgement. They need to say, Michael Schaps made this wine because Michael is one of the most renowned winemakers on the Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah.
And so they want that. That's marketing. That's spin. They actually use that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's still part of that process. We won the Governor's Cup this year with a wine that we made for the barns up at Hamilton Station up north.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you. And, it was a team. You know, it was a, you know, Michael's first one, you know, Ben Jordan was the winemaker there before I was. He's at Early Mountain now. He started the wine. I finished the wine as a winemaker, but the whole staff there, you know, it's a collective, you know, and it turns out that I actually grew those grapes the year before at Carge Mountain and Monticello up at Mount Juliet. And so there's this whole team that puts these wines together.
Yeah.
So on the end, they go, you know, Michael Schaps and his staff made this wine.
Sure, sure. So in the industry, it's like, okay, we know who did that, and that's cool and good for them. And
it's good for, you know, the whole idea behind Custom Crush is let's raise the bar of quality by having a really good staff that knows how to make wine, mm-hmm. that can make good wine, so that mom and pop startups don't have to figure out how to make wine and ruin a bunch of grape juice along the way and have to sell that, and the quality level goes down. And so the concept was, hey, if you're doing a startup, let us help you do that. We'll get you set up on the right foot you're going to have great wine to start.
Yeah.
And just keep that going.
I can't remember who it was. I was with someone and they were disparaging a winery because the wine wasn't made there. And I'm like, do you understand how this works? Like,
I have very good friends that, you know, we have this debate all the time.
Yeah.
And actually, I sit on the board for the Monticello Wine Trail, and this is a debate we have amongst the trail. So to be a member of the Monticello Wine Trail, you have to have a tasting room, you have to have a vineyard, and you have to have a production facility on site. You have to grow and make your own wine.
Okay.
So there are a bunch of wineries around that they really want to be on the Monticello Wine Trail. They can't because we make their wine for them.
Ah.
They grow their grapes, they send it to us, we make the wine and send it back.
Yeah.
They've got a vineyard and a tasting room, but they don't make their own wine.
Right.
Their wines are excellent. They grew them, or we helped them grow them, and they're selling them on their farm. So there's a lot of politics involved with ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tough thing because the owners are trying to protect their business models that are farms and the folks that are coming in. And there's a big pushback on the county level too of, you know, these event centers that are getting started all over the place. And they're using a farm winery license in order to operate a business in the county, because in El Morro County, it's illegal to have a business in the county.
Really?
Yeah. And people don't know that. And they're like, well, why don't you start a garage in the county to fix cars?
Yeah.
You can't. It is illegal.
What?
Yeah. Oh, no. That's a whole other podcast.
What?
I shouldn't even get started. So
you see my face. I'm like, really?
Yeah. It's a thing. And it's so for us in the industry, we're trying to protect that farm winery license above and beyond, you know, because that's our bread and butter.
Yeah.
If we lose the ability to have people come to our farms and buy wine, or lose the ability to have an event, the industry is sunk.
Absolutely.
We are agritourism.
Yes.
We have to have that. So we're very protective of those rights.
Yeah. I think remembering that it is a farm is very important. You know, you grow grapes, you have to depend on the seasons, on the whim of the tourist. Do they feel like coming out today? Is it going to rain? And then they really don't want to come out.
Please come anyway.
Come anyway. It's slow then. It's quiet then. You'll be able to chat with the tasting room person a lot more. You'll have more time. You won't have people behind you. Like,
every winery has a great view.
Absolutely they do. Absolutely they do. So many great reasons to come out when it's raining.
I feel like I'm still trying to answer your question about the view.
Do so much.
Have we hit that?
I love that you're kind of like this Renaissance man of wine, because it is becoming more specialized, where folks, you know, they're either one thing or the other thing. They don't know all of the things.
There's a few guys like me in the state who kind of have a broad brush approach to wine, but I'm one of the few guys that can go in and say, I can design your winery for you. I can do all of it. And that's just from the experience I've had building, you know, wineries around, around here. And then I hit a point as a winemaker. So now I'm primarily consulting. So
okay.
I'm driving around telling people, stop it, you know, don't do that or do this. And so as a winemaker, how do I stay relevant?
Yes. Now with your consulting, so you're consulting folks on designing vineyards or people on, or like more tourist-based, like where to go and who to visit?
Oh, no. I'm in production. So
okay.
I'm primarily the guy out walking around in your vineyard saying, you need to fix that.
You didn't
spray this right. You didn't do that. For God's sake, build a deer fence. You know, there's...
Yeah. Are you helping Justin with his Japanese beetle problem?
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely.
I'm sorry, listeners. My neighbor is starting a... he'll be very upset that I mentioned...
I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. I was very pleased because it means they won't be in my yard and my roses. So...
No. And that's, you know, Justin's got a half acre in his backyard. And then...
It's exciting to see it go up. I was so thrilled.
I'm a builder.
Yeah.
I love a project. Oh my God, give me a project. And that's where I'm the happiest, you know, building something. And so now I'm helping 16 people build things, and it's like, whew, okay, let's do this. Yeah.
I'm curious, what is the first thing you do when you design, like, to place vines? Do you look at the lay of the land, like the slope of the land, the wind direction, the way the sun's coming? Like,
Yes.
Yes to all of that. And why I ask is one of the articles I read about you, you source your grapes from this certain vineyard whose name escapes me because they grow up a slope.
Honnally? Yeah, like the song.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Puff the Magic Dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because of the slope of the land.
Absolutely.
And the way the wind hits it, and that's important.
That's so when someone calls me and says, "Hey, I'm thinking about planting grapes," my first reaction is always, "Don't." Yeah. Stop it. You don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
Just keep drinking wine. Yeah. That's the best part.
You really don't want to go there.
Like, let's just not do this. So then once they get over that, and they still want to talk to me, then I go out to their site and we walk around. And, you know, growing grapes is capturing sunlight, interpreting dirt through a grapevine, and having the expression of a place come out in a glass of wine.
Oh, that's beautiful.
That's what we do.
Yeah.
Like, so if you invite me over and, you know, you're on the river and it's low ground and it kind of smells funky down there, I don't want to plant a vineyard there.
No.
If you invite me out and we're standing on the top of a hill and I'm looking south and I can see Richmond, we're on. Like,
nice.
I want a vineyard. A vineyard is a solar collector. You got to be pointed at the sun. Mostly. There's
okay.
A lot of nuances that go on with this, what I'm saying, but you want to be pointed at the sun. When the sun comes up in the morning, you want the sunlight first. Like, you mm-hmm. want a clear view to the east, so when the sun comes up, dries the vineyard off. So you naturally compete. Your fungal competition goes down because
okay.
it's dry and the wind kicks up. And so you really want to be out in a beautiful place with a great view. And that's, you'll find that most of the wineries around here are sitting on top of a hill with a pretty good view.
Hmm. Yeah.
But I've, you know, I have other folks that insist on putting in a vineyard on their property because they already own the property. I teach classes at PVCC.
Oh, cool.
Viticulture classes.
You do?
I've been doing this for like 2 years. And I teach like 5 classes a year.
Oh, that's so cool.
It's the adult learning, you
know, yeah.
weekend, Saturday, 8 hours of dirt and stuff with Jake.
dirt and stuff with Jake. Is that the I love that.
Dirt and donuts.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of people that come in and they're like, you know, we inherited this farm from my family and we need to do something with it. We heard that grapes is the thing to do. And then we talk about ideals versus reality.
Yeah.
And ideally, if you're going to go start a vineyard, I'm going to ask you to buy property A because it's perfect. The reality is you already own property Z. It's not perfect, but how do I come in as a consultant and say, here's what you can do here to make this sustainable?
Okay. Okay.
That's, and I want to bring that word up because
mm-hmm.
the most important part of what I do is the creation of a sustainable business, because that's what agriculture really needs to be thought of as sustainable.
Yes.
We don't do biodynamic well here. We don't do organic well here. You know, Napa gets 15 inches of rain a year. We get 50.
Whoa.
It's hard to fight that kind of humidity and water
yeah.
organically.
Yes.
It's not, there's one guy doing it fairly well, but he's doing it with hybrid grapes that were designed in a lab to survive it.
Okay. So you gotta,
if you're trying to grow Chardonnay,
fight your battles,
you're not doing
somewhere.
It
somewhere. Right.
So
it's never gonna be 100% here.
Never. So for me as a consultant, it's my job to go in and go, well, you can do this because
mm-hmm.
I know these grapes will do well here. And it's a huge picture. We call it terroir.
Yeah.
Right? I like to use the German word, Gestalt. The big picture of your, you know, I kind of think of myself like looking down on these projects, and you have to see everything from the dirt to the roof line of how this business is going to operate and be there in 20 years.
Yes. the big picture.
And fill in all the gaps.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good way of looking at it, definitely. And then go in and fill in those details.
Yeah.
And what grapes do well here? And maybe this is the transition over to your talking about your wines. Because I was on the mall the other day and mentioned that I was talking to you. I was actually at the Coat Room in Brasserie and talking to Will Curley. You should have seen his face. Oh my God. The fate. He was so excited. Oh, I'm so glad you're talking to him. He like just giddy.
I love Will Curley. Yes, it's a lot of energy.
Yes, he does. I need to borrow some.
I have this gathering at my house occasionally. We call it Man Church. Which
I love it.
It's like tongue-in-cheek, you know, ridiculous thing that got started a long time ago. But so on Sundays, like this group of guys will just show up.
The Man Church.
You bring ingredients, you bring wine, and we cook.
Oh, that's so cool.
And we drink amazing wine and bullshit for a few hours and smoke cigars and everybody goes home. And so Mr. Curley is part of that crowd. And, God, he's a great cook, too.
I'm very excited. I'm actually headed down there tonight.
Excellent.
So I'm very excited. My husband doesn't know it yet. I'm surprising him.
Fantastic.
So, yes, but this podcast will be up much later. So I didn't just kill the surprise. But yeah, I got to see the new Coat Room and
I was there on opening night and it's brilliant.
It's so cool.
It's really, really cool.
Right.
It's so intimate and you know, I'm kind of an introvert. I like my own space and the idea of, you know, there's only four tables down there.
Yeah.
It's, like, you know, it's you and seven other people or whatever.
Yeah.
With your own bartender.
I know. Like, I know,
hallelujah.
Right. He's going to put a hurting on you, probably.
Yeah. So you asked the question, what grapes do well here? And tying that back to my own wine, they're not necessarily the same list, but there's some of them are. So my wines right now, in 2015, I started this project because I wanted to stay relevant as a winemaker. And I've always made wines of place.
Hmm.
When I make a wine, it says Pollock Vineyards on it. It says Keswick Vineyards on it. It says, you know, Grace Estate Winery on it.
Hmm.
My name is behind the wine somewhere, but it's not on the label. It's not, you know, so transitioning away from that. Now I'm a guy that has, you know, input on making wine for a lot of people, but I'm not the winemaker of any place.
Okay.
I want to remain a winemaker, a relevant winemaker in the industry. So the next step then is, okay, how do I do my own label? Which is not a place I ever wanted to find myself.
Yeah, no pressure.
Right?
Right.
So Michael, you know, I talked to Michael and he's like, yeah, let's make it here. So I'm making it as a private label through Wineworks as a custom crush, but I get to source my own fruit from the vineyards that I'm managing. So I can go out and go, these two rows of Viognier look exceptionally good. I'd like to have that. And so
that's fantastic.
It's so fantastic.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful place as a maker.
Yeah.
To find yourself being able to go, I want the best Cab Franc I can find.
Sure.
And maybe you don't find the best Cab Franc, but the best one I can find is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. And
I'm sitting here looking at the, help me pronounce this.
Viognier.
Viognier. Okay. I always say it wrong. This sold out. This is...
It's gone.
I was on your site. It's gone.
It's gone.
And and how much did you make of it?
I made two barrels. So part of my...
And that translates to how many bottles approximately?
50 cases.
50 cases. And what, 12 to a case?
Yep.
Okay.
And we sold it out in 4 months.
Whoa.
And that's, you know, without a tasting room, that's me making some noise. And well, and it's me
That's pretty cool. Like that, did you feel, that's great.
I was very surprised.
See?
And you know, I'm a worrywart and a pessimist. And I was like, this is never going to work. And it's working.
A testament to your skill.
It seems to be working.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a testament to being conscious of who you are as a character as you go through, you know, this process of living. I try desperately not to burn bridges. I've tried very hard to have positive reactions with all the people I work with, and built a following for good wine because of the wineries that I've worked at.
Right.
Because we were all driving the quality. You know, I want to, you know, the folks that are buying my wine, you know, there's new people who are experiencing it, but there's also people that have been following me around for 15 years going, hey man, I want a case of that. When's it ready? And that's spectacular.
Yeah.
So right now I'm making Viognier. I have a Cabernet Franc and what we're calling Fate, which is F8.
Yeah.
On the label.
That's the one Will was crazy about.
So those varieties.
Has that come out?
I haven't released it yet.
It's bottled. Okay.
I'm slipping it out here and there to dinner once in a while.
Okay.
Just to get feedback.
Okay.
And
that was a grape I'm not familiar with. What Tannat?
It's the state grape of Uruguay.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never had wine from Uruguay.
It comes from southern France.
So, okay.
My brain's old and full of holes, but I'll come back to the name, where it comes from, the region it comes from. Big, bold, tannic, huge wines that you can't drink for 10 years. Mataran is the wine that they make in France. It's also used as a port grape.
Oh, wow.
So it has that strength.
Yeah. Fortified.
Yeah. No, it's a gnarly monster. And I like big red wine. Like, I really like big red wine. And so I had the opportunity to work with Tannat at Grace Estate, and it wasn't the best site for it, but I learned a lot about the grape, and I felt like it's a grape for Virginia in the right site that's going to just blow a lot of vinifera or the other European varietals out of the water because of its density, its color, its natural acidity. It has these crazy flavors. So when you drink wine, your brain tells you, immediately you put it in your face and your brain goes blueberries, strawberries, whatever the nuance of the fruit is, it triggers that reaction in people.
Yeah.
Tannat, you put it in your face and go, what the hell is that? And everybody stops and goes, what is this? And you know,
I had that with the Norton the first time I tried it.
Yeah.
I was like, what is
this? This is bubblegum. Weird.
Yeah. I still don't know what I was tasting. I only had it once.
Yeah, that's enough for most people.
It's enough for most people.
Not a fan. I've grown a lot of it.
Right.
Not a fan of the wine.
It's weird. It's a weird one.
And that's what we're selling to. We want that hook in the nose when you put a glass of wine in front of your face. We want you to go, oh, wow. Because aromatics make more of an impression on people than a flavor profile.
With smells.
Yeah.
With wine. Yeah, I could see that.
I will remember how a person smells as opposed to what their name is for years, right?
Right? Oh, I'm that way too.
Well, you're that dude that smelled really funky when we met.
No. Well, the scent memory, that happens to me. So if I have a perfume I haven't put on for years, I will put it on and immediately have a memory of when I wore it.
Yeah.
Like back in the day when whatever that period of my life was, whether good or bad.
Totally the wine experience.
Really?
And, you know, the percentage of your reaction to a glass of wine or the experience of having wine, how much of it is aromatic? That's a lot. Unless you're sitting on the porch slugging it.
Right, right.
If you're having dinner or you're talking to somebody and you're actually somewhat focused, it's gonna make or break that wine.
It makes sense because some wines have lavender in them, and you don't really eat. I mean, you can eat lavender, but not like.
Okay. That's the story of that wine. It has a voice, an aromatic voice that's unique, and it makes you go, huh? And then the wine's really good when you drink it. So I blended it with Petit Verdot, which another big. Loud,
right.
Obnoxious red wine. You put the two together, and it's like a choir.
Ta-da!
The choir of darkness.
Yeah.
Like, yes.
Back to your gothic roots.
Exactly.
Punk gothic roots.
So that was sort of something that I learned to do at Grace, and then I found a vineyard that actually grows those grapes really well, and the resulting wine is really fantastic. The F8 name actually is a field designation. Those grapes came from field 8. So when I started designing this label, F8 was the thing. I didn't think about it. And then I took it to my designer over at Watermark, and Darcy's like, oh, Fate, that's a really good idea. I was like, oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Okay,
we can call
it that.
It was Fate that it ended up being Fate. You didn't even think of that.
It did not go through the brain. It's like, oh, wow.
And the labels, beautiful. So unique. I'm not even kidding. It's like watercolor.
It's a photograph.
What?
It's a photograph of Petit Verdot wine running down the barrel of the press while we were pressing it off.
Are you kidding? I thought it was a painting.
No, this is so... Watermark Design, fantastic group of people.
Agreed.
I took him this photograph and I was like, Darcy, I want this to be my label background. And I was like, but it can't look like blood, because that's what it looks like right now. Because it was like totally red. And then they started playing with color.
It's stunning. It's so simple and so unique. Like if I saw it in a row of other wines on a shelf, I would know it was yours.
Yeah.
I'd be like, well, that's a Jake Bushing wine right there.
And that comes back to that. I don't make wine. I make wine of place, but I don't have a place. So my label has to be an expression of self.
Totally.
So now it's a piece of art that's still wine.
Yeah.
But I had a long conversation about labels with a friend of mine, and she's just like, well, you're an artist, so why don't you put art on the bottle?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Sarah. And she was right. And then they kind of did the cutout here to make it interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm keeping it simple. There's not a lot on this bottle. It says it was where it was made, what it is, but I'm leaving impressions of the wine to you. I'm not going to tell you what this tastes like.
Sure.
Because I don't know what it tastes like to you.
Right.
No idea. I know what it tastes like to me, but I'm not going to tell you that.
Oh, I loved when Sarah Gorman said something similar at Cardinal Point. She's, you tell me which one you think should win a medal.
Yeah.
I loved that.
Yes.
Because everybody has their own preference. Yeah. Or, you know, what's the best wine? It's the one you like to drink. It's the one that you enjoy the most.
Yeah, Very nice. I don't know how they do it. Working in a tasting room is really hard for me.
Right? Do you have favorites? Do you have like one that you gravitate toward?
Tasting rooms?
Or tasting rooms or wines? Like,
you know, it's weird. I've been doing this long enough where when I have downtime, I am not going to wineries.
Right.
Because I'm there. I'm there all the time. So I have favorite clients that I work with and favorite people in the industry and obviously favorite wines. And, you know, it's like food. People ask you, what's your favorite food?
Oh, I get that a lot. Yeah.
You don't have an answer to that.
Mm-mm.
There is no answer to that. And then for wine,
what day
it's the
is
same
it?
Thing. It's like, I don't know, what's the temperature and where am I and what am I eating?
Yeah.
You know, what am I in a bitchy mood or do I feel good today?
Exactly.
So I was thinking about chilling this down, having this open when you're here, and then I decided not to because I don't want to have that. I'm going to send this home with you and I want you to drink it and then I'll get some feedback from you. But I want real feedback in a place where you're drinking wine the way you would.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, you know, it. So
I'm honored.
That's sharing the experience.
Yeah, I know exactly.
Dissecting it, you know.
I already have plans for this bottle. Thank you so much. Oh my God, how exciting!
I think most of the makers in the industry, that's the experience they want you to have. Mm-hmm. They don't want to sit and dissect a wine with you because when I taste wine, I don't taste it like normal people. The first thing I do is go, all right, what are the flaws? You know, what's wrong with this wine? Because as a consultant, that's my job. So when I drink wine, I'm like, okay, the winemaker did this, the vineyard did this.
Yeah.
And you start breaking it down. I can't help it. Like, you get so ingrained putting something in your mouth. I aerate milk, you know, like.
It's like coffee, milk.
I'm drinking water going. My son's like, Dad, you're doing that thing.
You're doing that thing again.
Yeah.
That's funny. That's funny.
Yeah.
So did you, I'm sure you have an excellent, fabulous palate. Does the layman wine drinker, do they even need to do that? Like,
No. God, no. Please don't do that.
Like, training your palate to recognize certain flavors and mm-hmm. things like that.
I think it's, if you're
going to be... Or is it more, it's more gut instinctual what you taste when you drink it?
The more you start to learn, the more dangerous you get. You know, being judgmental.
Ah, yes.
And then it gets really hard. If you learn too much, it becomes hard to enjoy wine.
Uh-huh.
Like, wines have to be, you know, suddenly...
A certain caliber.
It has to go, like, no. So I hit a point with wine where I can turn that off and go, well, we're just here drinking. We're going to enjoy this. This bottle costs $8. It was made, you know, by machines. But it's still delicious. Great.
Mm-hmm.
Bang. You know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If you school yourself to the point where you can't enjoy wine anymore because you know too much about it, mm-hmm. you really kind of screwed yourself out of something beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like being able to eat. Like, if Charlottesville can spoil the hell out of you as an eater. Oh,
totally.
My God. And if I go to a place now and, you know, you have to be conscious of what wine did you just pick up? What restaurant am I in? Am I at Brasserie and is this amazing? Or did I go to Tip Top and
yeah.
be conscious of where you are? Tip Top's great.
It's yes,
it
is. One
of my favorite restaurants in town.
Yeah.
Because I can go there and get a plate of food and it's be like, oh, God, thank you.
Yeah, right? Soul filling.
Yes, thank you.
It's so good.
So it's perspective. Everything we do is perspective, I think.
And I'm curious because I get this a lot. People come visit me or I go visit them and they are very intimidated to take me anywhere because of what I do for a living.
Right.
Do you get that? Like people come over, I'm sure this is not a very good bottle of wine, but you know, it got good reviews and like, are they in?
Yes. Oh no.
Yeah.
And I can't go out to eat with people now without being the guy who orders the wine.
Oh, you always have to pick
it
out.
That.
You always do.
It's like, oh no, you order because we don't know what we're doing. I'm like, you drink more wine than I do. Like,
yeah.
Order some wine. You know, so yeah, that gets really weird. It gets really weird.
What do you do? Like,
oh, I usually just throw it back at him. I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm having bourbon.
I'm off tonight.
I'm like, I'm having a gin and tonic.
Yeah.
You drink what you want.
I have family members. I've told them 18 times, I like hot dogs. I'll eat a dirty water hot dog. I don't care.
Yes.
We can go anywhere.
Absolutely.
But, and I'm like, oh, geez. God.
No, that's Charlottesville, though. I mean,
go
to Richmond and say that.
Yeah.
Someone's going to punch you.
Right. I know.
Like, hot dogs are great.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
And I love eating up.
Eating up.
I'm...
What do you mean by that?
I come from the country, and like, I eat grocery store food all the time. People are like, well, "Where do you go? Where do you get your food?" I'm like, "Food Lion. It's on the way home. It's right there."
Can I give a shout out to Food Lion?
Hell yes.
Deviled egg potato salad.
Oh yeah.
It's in the prepared section. Holy shit! It's so good.
Yeah. How many times a month do I come home with a rotisserie chicken from Food Lion?
Totally.
Way more than I want to admit.
Hello, Jacques Pepin on his cooking show recommends the space pod chicken more than once. That's Stephen King actually coined that. He calls it space pod chicken.
Love it.
But it's like three meals. You pull it off the bone. You can put it, you can make chicken salad with it.
No,
you can do all kinds of stuff with it.
But my point is, when I say eating up, like, I don't eat like my Instagram makes me look like.
Absolutely, yeah.
I go out to eat a couple times a week. I'm in the industry. I know a lot of restaurateurs. I have wine downtown. I'm part of that community. I love that community. Everybody's striving to do something amazing. Absolutely love it. If I could eat, you know, at any restaurant for the rest of my life, it would probably be Fleury. Because
oh God, no kidding.
Good grief. But I can't. And it's the same thing. I don't drink $100 bottles of wine every night or ever.
People think you do,
and
though.
They think I do.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a member of the Wine Guild, and we buy wholesale, and I like buying cases of $9 wine because it's delicious, and I don't have to think about it. And so, yeah.
I need to join the Wine Guild. I haven't gotten around to doing that yet. Yeah. Their tasting nights on Wednesdays are so sweet.
We kind of shut her down in the summer, but
yeah,
once it starts cooling off and people come back to town, you know, everyone's at the beach.
Yeah.
We know you're all at the beach.
I'm going next week.
I go to Minnesota to cool down.
So. Oh, here she goes.
Yeah.
Right, right. God, this is a great conversation. I'm trying. Have we covered everything? I don't know.
I have no idea. I don't know.
You know what? I do want to bring up your marketing skills. Because when I went to do research on you, you're a lot of places. There's articles and your Instagram and your Facebook. How do you handle, and I'm being totally selfish with this question, how do you handle all of that while making wine and consulting? Because you're one guy. I'm having trouble. It's like an animal that needs to be fed all the time and cared for all the time, or it dies.
Right.
People drift away.
Yeah.
What do you do?
I feel like I don't do it well.
I think you do it very well.
Because of that thing where I'm just like, I'm running constantly.
Yeah.
So I'm a single dad. I have shared custody of a 9-year-old. And so I have him every other day, for at least a portion of the day. And the one goal in my life with him is to, when I'm with him, everything else gets shut off.
Like, oh, that's cool.
Be a dad, right?
Yeah.
Like, try to consciously be a dad. The second thing is surviving all this other shit that's going on. And the marketing thing for me, I'm in a position where I've built wineries for enough people, and my past has been, you know, I've been in good positions to have positive marketing happening around me.
Right.
And I was the general manager. You know, Pollock Vineyards really made that happen, where, you know, the Pollocks were the owners. They weren't the face of the winery. They really made me into that. And so Nick Doval and I were the face of Pollock Vineyards. And all the marketing we did there was at a critical time for the industry.
Hmm.
We were in the top echelon of quality and service, and it was a great facility, and so we got a lot of marketing energy around that place. I got connected to all the bloggers and the newspapers, and so I had these friendships, the governor's mansion. I mean, you meet this network of people that are really focused on building the industry, and then they start following you around going, hey, what are you doing next? And then next I would do this, and they would say, let's do an interview, let's talk about your new project. And that keeps going. So I have a list of people I can call and say, hey, this is happening, you know, are you interested in making some noise about it? That's how I've launched this my own label, was through the help of bloggers and,
so smart,
you know, people like Aaron Scala,
yeah,
and, you know, Frank Morgan. These guys are total wine geeks. They're Virginia wine geeks, and they love the backstory, because I'm not some guy that retired from some massive whatever, built a, what we like to call a monument to ego.
I don't have
one of those.
Right.
I'm a farm boy that's an artist that wants to create something, and I think they appreciate that kind of story in this industry that's kind of top heavy on ownership.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned, one of the articles I read, you mentioned legacy, like building a legacy.
Legacy is weird.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing, because I've been building legacy for other people for 20 years. And it's hard for me to swallow that pill and say, okay, it's time to put yourself on a pedestal, because that is not something I am comfortable with at all. And so how do I do that without, you know, losing the sense of who I really am?
So it's not a monument to ego.
No.
It's actually just a really solid representation of your work and of you.
I really want to make wine. I love it. Absolutely love it. And, you know, if the question gets posed, you know, what's your ideal end game? What's the situation? If I meet the right investor and they've got the right property and they say, hey, you know, let's build you a winery, there's no way I could say no to that.
Sure.
But I'm also keenly aware of my own failings as a human, and I'm not, you know, I have no idea how that would work out.
Yeah.
I'm pretty happy doing what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, I can tell. The passion, enthusiasm comes through so clear. Have you turned down people because you got the sense that it was a monument to ego and you just didn't want to go there?
Yeah. I'm nodding yes. Yeah, and it's, you know, and that's a conversation that Michael and I have a lot, because Michael runs the winery. It's his business. He pays me as a consultant to take care of all the grapes for all of his clients. Mm-hmm. And I do winery management. And we'll have people call and they'll be like, yeah, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this and blah, blah, blah. And we look at each
like
other
the
and go,
exit.
No, we're not going to do that. And so, yeah, I went out on this site visit, you know, last spring, and somewhere close to Richmond. So it was a marginal site for grapes, but they really wanted to do weddings and focus on this wedding thing. And I just could not handle the character of the people that I was talking to. And I got back and I was like, Michael, this is a no-go.
Yeah.
Like, even if they're worth this much money, you know, for us to be involved in this, it would be bad marketing down the road, I guarantee you. Mm-hmm. But the stress involved with dealing with those kind of people when I'm already running 80 hours a week.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. So, and it's nice to actually be in a position where the business is operating well enough where I can say, well,
yeah,
we're kind of tapped out here with time.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, that being said, I'm still constantly looking for new projects and new people to work with, and because that's lifeblood.
Yeah, no
and
kidding. Keeps you going.
My job ends at a certain point. I'm a consultant. I get you up and running, get you knowledgeable, and then you don't need me.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so there's this evolution of projects that kind of come and go. And, you know, I might stay affiliated with them and drop by once a month to go, hey, you're doing great.
Right, right.
Yeah. And that's
building that network, yeah, too, for your own wines.
Absolutely.
Do you have a favorite part, like, of what you do where you're just like, oh, I get to do this today. I love it.
You know, we all bitch and moan about it, but harvest is the culmination of what you do for a year.
Hmm.
And
I'd like to witness that.
Oh, man.
I don't want to invite myself, but...
No. And to
I would
truly,
really like to see
when we
it.
Say harvest, people don't understand it, because they'll come in and they'll see the bustle of grapes flying around and you're filling the press and there's juice and you're picking and there's tractors and everybody's singing in Spanish and, you know, all this crazy stuff going on. What they don't realize is that starts August 25th and it ends October 25th. Every day for 100 hours a week, you have this grinder and you don't necessarily have control over it, because if there's a hurricane coming, there's harvest is this beautiful dichotomy of pain and joy. I mean, it really is. I love it. I hate it. And I love it. And, I let myself gain weight all year because harvest is coming, and I'm going to lose 14 pounds.
You know it's going to happen. You're like, it's all good. Harvest is coming. Yeah.
And when I was 26 or 27, you know, oh my God, I could do harvest all year. I love that energy. I'm kind of a spazzy person. But now that I'm 47, it's like, a nap on Sunday would be really great. Really, really good.
Your body's like, what are you doing?
Yeah,
like, you're not 26 anymore.
No. And, you know, and how do you have a family through that?
Exactly. Does your son ever come with you, like help out?
I kind of have this rule where, and I learned it with my first child is 19, and I kind of learned this with him. Don't take your kids to work. Right?
Yeah.
And people don't, like, I have friends in the industry that are owners who have kids, and they're like, oh yeah, the kids are at work, you know, they're in the winery all the time. It's your winery. It's your home. I go to work every day. I don't take my kid to go work for somebody else in the winery.
Oh, God. Yeah, right? Yeah.
And people don't, because they see me doing this, and they're like, oh, it's your life. It's your, yes, it is. But the reality is I'm getting paid to do a job for someone else. I'm not going to bring my child into that.
So yeah.
I really try to not, because I'm gone enough as it is.
Sure, and, sure.
And thankfully, my ex will, you know, typically make that time up when I can't get to him. Like, it's harvest, and, you know, she can't get to that most of the time. But it's hard. It's really hard.
And if he comes to it later, then great. You know, you can show him
some
things.
Yeah. Absolutely. And he's been, don't get me wrong, he's been on lots of picks. but I try not to make it a habit.
Sure, sure. What do you enjoy when you're not making wine or helping others make wine? What do you, if you have any spare time at all, what do you enjoy doing?
I like to run away to Minnesota.
Yeah,
my girlfriend, cool off. My girlfriend's in Minnesota. It's a long, convoluted story, but so we see each other about every 40 days where she'll come down here.
Oh,
I go up there.
Long distance.
Yeah, she's got kids, I got kids, we got exes, we're, you know.
Working it out.
And so when I get time to disappear, that's where I go.
Nice, absolutely. Nice.
And around town, if I'm here, I like to go hang out with, the industry, the downtown, the whole restaurant crowd and...
Yeah, over at Justin's.
Or at Justin's house. Or actually, I have people here more than I go. I like to bring people here.
Oh, nice. It's a good space for
it. It's my space. I don't have to deal with downtown and,
the parking and the whole,
yeah. This is a great space for a shindig.
Yeah, and so close to the city, the city, the hamlet.
The hamlet. Our lovely
the shire.
Hamlet.
The shire of Charlottesville. Well, I have loved this.
It's been fantastic.
Yeah, it was so exciting to meet you because I've heard you came preloaded with all these awesome compliments. So to finally meet the man behind the compliments was a real treat for me. So
thank you.
Yeah, let's end up with a couple of speed round,
all right, let's
which
do it.
You are familiar with.
I am.
As a listener.
I've been thinking about
thank
my
you.
Answers for like a year now.
Yeah. Really?
Well, yeah.
Sure. I'll have to ask you a new one. All right. Do you have a favorite kitchen utensil that you use if you cook?
Yeah, it's
if
so
and when
funny.
You cook.
It's the same. It's actually Sarah's answer. Tongs.
Tongs.
Yeah, I have multiple pairs of them, and same thing. And I grill a lot. Like,
50%
of my food comes off that grill out there. So,
yeah,
tongs are very, very important.
Very useful for that. All right, secret junk food vice.
Oh God, I can't. Yes. If I buy a box of Little Debbie's Swiss cake rolls, I will eat the entire thing. Like, I can't stop. Like, it's just like...
I haven't had one of those in years.
Don't do it.
Just don't do it.
They're worse than Pringles for me. I was like, oh my God, so much paraffin wax. Yummy. Can't stop.
Paraffin wax.
Can't stop eating them.
On top of the chocolate.
Right?
That's right.
It's like this waxy, horrible chocolate-like substance.
Oh, but they're so good.
They're so good.
Do you have a Bodo's order? Do you get to Bodo's every?
I actually don't. There was a time period where, and this is actually one of the things I was thinking about bringing up in our conversation, and we just whipped through all this stuff. But I love being a mentor to industry people, so I've had that opportunity at all these wineries where I have staff, and one of the last guys I was working with. He would stop at Bodo's every morning and bring stuff out to the farm because I lived out there. And it was always a breakfast, sausage, egg, and cheese.
Oh, yeah.
On the multi-grain whatever. And, oh, man, we ate a lot of those.
Yeah.
It was delicious.
So the deli egg is really good, I've heard.
I haven't had that.
Yeah, for breakfast. That's a good... They kind of just put everything together in a patty. It's like eggs and meat together or something. It's delicious. Do you have a... favorite food city that you'd fly to if I gave you a ticket right now?
I am so horribly traveled that's a really long list probably. But with the way I like to eat, I have to think it would be, on an island in Greece probably, or I love the simple, like that whole Mediterranean, they don't overdo it. It's not a ton of butter.
Right.
A lot of people say, oh, go to Paris. I recognize where, yes, that would be absolutely incredible. But for me, it's the finesse and elegance in a simple dish, that sings a whole, that's a pure song for me, I guess.
Yeah, where you can taste the ingredients.
Yeah.
They kind of come through because of the simple preparation.
Southern Italian, like just a little olive oil and an anchovy. I'm good.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice. Whatever. All right, biscuits or cornbread?
Yeah, that's a hard one because I grew up without both.
Oh, right.
You were
culturally taught at the Holiday Inn.
Who wants Lutefisk? No one. So they both have their place. It's biscuits in the morning and cornbread at night.
Oh, that's very diplomatic, yes.
But it's true,
it's
right?
True. Like, it's true.
Bean soup and cornbread. Heck yeah.
Oh my God, you can't beat that with a stick.
That's so good.
That's good stuff. All right, and this is the tough question because you're in wine. Who do I talk to next on Audacious?
There's a whole long list.
Yeah.
That's a really hard thing to answer without, you know, I want to include all these amazing people that are in the industry. But listening to your show, my answer, I kind of want to challenge you to take a step in a slightly different direction. I have two answers, and the first one only because you may have talked to him already.
Okay.
Joe Scala.
No.
Aaron's husband.
No, but I need to because he runs front of house like nobody else.
So his new, the place he's running now, Common House.
Oh, downtown. Yeah.
It's that downtown sort of private club thing. I got to tour it the other day, and I was just, you know, it's perfect.
Is it? Wow.
and Joe's amazing. I mean, he is the best front of house guy in the state.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy is, his work is impeccable.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think for you, for us, food, wine, the guy that makes it all amazing.
Yes.
You know, and so that's sort of, that. I think that's a good answer.
It's an excellent answer. There's a reason Fleury, for me, won best of last year.
Absolutely.
Because you can walk in that restaurant and just kind of go, help me.
Yeah.
Like, I put myself in your hands and I trust you.
When I walk in, I hand the menu back. I say, feed me until I say stop.
Yeah.
And that includes wine.
Just so bring food.
Aaron just brings, like, whatever glass that she's got, bottles that she's stealing wine out of, and then just shows up, and you never know the staff is there because they're so perfectly trained. It's like ghost food just appears, and your conversation, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah.
Excellent answer.
Can I give you the second
name? Of course.
So I'm trying to think of people that do both wine and food and have a perspective that's unique to their position.
Okay.
Michael Davis. Personal friend.
Yeah.
But he's one of Will Ritchie and Will Ritchie's partners in 10 Course Hospitality. That's the company that runs all of Will's restaurants and the Wine Guild. So Michael is the Wine Guild. That's how he's known. But he's also one of Will's partners in all these managing these businesses. So he has a really keen wine experience going on. Mm. And at the same time, he has a view on the business side of managing and running restaurants and that whole thing.
And running them here.
In Charlottesville.
Which is a unique place to run a restaurant.
Where he was a musician.
Ah, there we go. And, back to the beginning.
It's like, you know, he was in 80s hair bands though, so that doesn't count.
No, he wasn't.
Yeah, no, there's pictures.
I want to see the pictures. Yeah. I want to see the pictures.
So I thought long and hard about those answers, and I think that's a perspective that I haven't heard on the show, and I think that would be, it'd be a really interesting conversation with either one of those guys.
Oh, I will talk to both of them.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. This was a delightful and such a treat for me.
Absolutely my pleasure.
Great. Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
What do you think? Right? Good stuff. Good stuff. I went and bought all the wines, guys, all the wines. I know he just released his orphan wine at Tavola. Was that last week or the week before? I know it has just been released. They had a tasting at Tavola. And George over at the Wine Guild is handling orders. Go to jakebushingwines.com, place your order, and George Minor will set you up with any and or all of the wines in the lineup that is Jake Bushing Wines. I've got 4 bottles waiting for me when I get back to Charlottesville tomorrow. Gonna go visit George and say hey, and then enjoy some this weekend, and I hope that you will do the same, and I hope that you've enjoyed this conversation, and I want to thank you for being my guest today. Be good to each other. Check out patreon.com/audaciouspod if you'd like to sponsor this podcast and help me grow. And check out teej.fm and all the great offerings that WTJU is offering as part of their podcast collaborative. A lot of UVA students are putting their wares out there, putting their creativity out there. A lot of folks in the community have podcasts as part of the collaborative. Check them all out at teej.fm. And thanks for being my guest. Audacious.co. I'm at iTunes. I would love a review. I've got a newsletter. You can sign up at the website. And until next time, from a porch in Dougspur, Virginia, at twilight. Oh my God, I just saw a hawk. Wow! He just flew across my sight of vision and landed in a tree. Man, is... Oh my God, nature is so fucking cool, isn't it? I love it. All right, I'm going to go enjoy a glass of wine and finish up this podcast before I have to head back to civilization tomorrow. Cheers, guys. Take care, and I will see you next time. When it comes to making those connections, when it comes to experiencing nature, when it comes to porch sitting, I'm audacious, and I hope you are too. See you next time. Cheers.